Welcome everyone to the teleclass, Current Issues in Infectious Disease and Microbicide Use in Infection Control. My name is Paul Weber, and at this point I would usually say that on behalf of my colleague and friend, Dr. Syed Sattar, we are very pleased to have you along. Today, of course, Dr. Sattar is right here with us and can speak for himself, but we are, of course, delighted that you've joined us. More than 3 years ago, Dr. Sattar and I met to devise a method whereby we could bring the best possible infection control information to the widest audience with the fewest barriers to participation. And out of that came the idea for teleclass education. We tried out our idea in June of 2001 when Dr. Sattar gave the very first teleclass. And since then, literally hundreds of thousands of people from every continent on the globe have joined either a live teleclass or they've listened to one of our recordings. And we're particularly proud that healthcare professionals in developing nations use teleclass information very widely and much more so every month. The registration fees that you folk pay help to make that possible, and I want to thank you very much for that. Now, Dr. Sattar is a world-renowned researcher, lecturer, teacher. His work is regularly referenced in other teleclasses, and it is to him that the smartest people in the world turn when they need a properly researched opinion on disinfection and antisepsis. He is a low-key and soft-spoken man, yet he's responsible for some enormous changes in the way that we look at disinfection, and it is indeed my honor to be able to introduce him to you again. So to present the teleclass, Current Issues in Infectious Disease and Microbicide Use in Infection Control, from the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology, I give you Dr. Syed Sattar.
Good morning, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Paul Weber, for your very generous comments, as always. And I also want to thank Paul for the opportunity to present yet another teleclass, and I believe this is my fifth one in the series. As before, I'll speak for about 45 to 50 minutes and then answer as many questions as possible. As you well know, infectious disease control relies heavily on the proper use of microbicides. However, things are constantly changing with regards to infectious agents we confront and the nature and safety of chemicals used in infection control. I shall present my views, which I hope will stimulate further discussion on the topic. Slide number 2. Here is how I have structured my presentation. I will start by giving you some basic facts on the worldwide impact of infectious agents, recent discoveries on human pathogens, and the mounting evidence on the links between infectious agents and chronic disorders in humans. It may be a surprise to many that modernization is in fact making us more prone to attack by infectious agents. I will illustrate this point with some examples. This next point is essentially to refresh your memory and reiterate that the spread of many types of infections can be interrupted by the proper use of microbicides. Before I go any further, allow me to define the term microbicide as used in this presentation. It is any chemical used to kill microorganisms to prevent and control the spread of infectious diseases. I prefer this term these days instead of the word germicide. My focus here will be hard surface disinfectants, meaning those that are meant for use on environmental surfaces as well as medical devices. I will not discuss topicals because they are a category unto themselves. But how safe and effective are the chemicals we use as microbicides? Discussion on this point is targeted towards manufacturers as well as end users. I will then tell you what I would consider to be an ideal microbicide and why. This will be followed by some recent data on the activity of microbicides against surrogates of noroviruses, the SARS virus, and the spores of the bacterium that causes anthrax. Then there will be some summary and concluding remarks. Slide number 3. As this pie chart shows, infectious agents continue to have a significant impact on human health throughout the world, being directly responsible for nearly 18 million fatalities, or one-third of the deaths that occur per year. Just to put things in perspective, this number is more than half the current population of Canada. The impact is even higher in developing countries, where nearly half of all fatalities are due to infections. Please remember that these figures are gross underestimations from two angles. Identifying the actual cause of death is often difficult, especially in developing countries where the vast majority of the population lives. And as will be shown below, there is increasing recognition of infectious agents as primary or cofactors in chronic conditions leading to death. The diagnostic and epidemiological tools we have are just not sophisticated enough to identify and record such causes of death. Slide number 4. These figures were published by a research team in the UK led by Taylor, and the paper appeared in 2001. They sifted through published literature and identified some 1,400 human pathogenic bacteria, viruses, prions, fungi, protozoa, and helminths. At the moment, this is the most comprehensive listing of human pathogens available, and it brings out several important points, including the fact that over 60% of these pathogens are zoonotic, meaning that they come to humans from animals, and that in spite of major advances in infectious disease research, we know very little about the modes and vehicles of more than 200 of these human pathogens. This lack of knowledge obviously makes the identification and institution of proper disease control measures very difficult. Infections that may not cause death or serious disabilities are also important in that they cause huge economic losses through healthcare costs and millions of work and school days lost per year. It should also be noted that we continue to discover new human pathogens, having identified some 40 new ones in the past 35 years or so. Who says that the golden era of microbiology ended with Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch? Please remember that many of these newly discovered pathogens are quite significant and not some rare bug somewhere in a remote corner of the world. Good examples here are HIV, which I'm sure every one of you is familiar with by now, noroviruses, and of course, the SARS virus. As mentioned earlier, we now know of at least 30 infectious agents that can cause delayed or chronic damage in those infected. I will soon show you examples of such pathogens. We have no easy way to calculate the human health impact and economic damage due to the long-term consequences of such infections. Another fascinating aspect here is that infectious agents may actually change the behavior of the host they infect. And the change in the behavior appears to help the spread of the respective pathogen. One well-known example of that, of course, is the rabies virus, which induces an infected dog, for example, to bite other potential hosts, thus spreading the infection very effectively. Toxoplasma gondii, a protozoan parasite, is well known for its ability to cause birth defects if an infection occurs during the early stages of pregnancy. More recently, it has been found that rats infected with this parasite lose their fear of the cat, their natural predator, making it easier for the parasite to complete its life cycle in nature. Others suggest that such infection-related changes in behavior can also occur in humans as well, and this is evolving into a very active area of research. Yet another fascinating discovery is the potential of certain viruses, including human adenovirus 36, to trigger obesity in non-human primates such as monkeys. This association is now termed infectobesity. If these observations are further confirmed and extended to humans, one can imagine vaccinations against certain forms of obesity. Slide number 5. Someone once said, all diseases are infectious diseases. This may yet turn out to be quite a prophecy, because more and more disorders are being found to be direct or indirect consequences of infections. This table contains examples of infectious agents that can cause delayed damage in humans. The types of damage include gastric ulcers, cancers, birth defects, paralysis, as well as heart and kidney problems. Cardiovascular diseases, which are generally ascribed to unhealthy diet and lifestyles, are among the major causes of morbidity and mortality. There is now good evidence showing that certain types of infectious agents, for example, chlamydia and viruses, can be important primary or cofactors in heart disease. The post-polio syndrome is quite an enigma indeed. Paralytic poliomyelitis as a disease is at the verge of being eradicated. But in the U.S. alone, there are over 300,000 adults who are at risk from accelerated weakening of their motor functions from a relatively mild childhood encounter with a poliovirus. At one time, there were doubts about the ability of viruses to cause cancer, but not anymore. Several types of viruses have now been clearly linked to cancers in humans. Indeed, bacteria such as Helicobacter pylori are also etiologically associated with human cancers. Slide number 6. This may come as a surprise to some, but several ongoing demographic and lifestyle changes are increasing our exposure and susceptibility to infectious agents. In other words, modernization and industrialization are making us more vulnerable to attack by many microbial pathogens. This diagram lists several of these factors, many of which are probably already familiar to most of you. We have published on this topic, and I'll be happy to provide more information to those interested. Slide number 7. This diagram is to set the stage for what I'm about to say using microbicides in infection control. In the vertical mode of spread, an infectious agent enters the developing fetus directly from the blood of the mother. Infection of the fetus may result in birth defects. A good example here is rubella virus, which causes German measles. Once a pregnant woman is infected, no amount of environmental control can prevent the infection of the fetus. Vaccination of women of childbearing age is the best way to prevent the spread of such infections. In indirect horizontal spread, an infectious agent can be transferred from an infected to a susceptible host by intimate body contact. Many sexually transmitted diseases fall into this category, and here again, environmental control through microbicides plays virtually no role in preventing such infections. A possible exception here may be the use of microbicide-containing vaginal gel. Most infections, however, spread through indirect horizontal transfer, and this is where microbicides can be important in infection control. We see this in our daily lives. For example, the water we drink is purified and treated with a microbicidal chemical such as chlorine. A breakdown in water disinfection can lead to disasters, as was evidenced in the Walkerton incident. Infection control practitioners in particular rely on proper hand antisepsis to prevent the spread of nosocomial infections. Slide number 8. Here is a pretty comprehensive list of the uses of microbicides and should convince even the most serious skeptic that there is indeed much reliance on such chemicals in our daily lives. Some 300 different kinds of chemicals are used for the purposes listed here. Slide number 9. However, as shown here, many microbicides are now under attack from several angles. Of course, major among these concerns is their known or potential toxicity to humans and the environment. This alone is leading to much review and soul searching at local, regional, national, and international levels. While the review and soul searching I'm referring to relate to unsafe chemicals in general, microbicides definitely constitute a subset. I can assure you that in the days to come, the production and sale of microbicidal chemicals will be subjected to much greater scrutiny. More on this a little later. Slide number 10. Quite paradoxically, our reliance on microbicides is increasing in spite of these concerns. But why? Well, we have increasing numbers of immunosuppressed individuals. These may be AIDS patients, organ transplant recipients, or those on cancer therapy. Increasing life expectancy is also rapidly enlarging the pool of the immunosuppressed due to advanced age alone. We are also discovering opportunistic pathogens which may be more resistant to chemotherapy. Fungi and environmental mycobacteria are good examples here. Then there are emerging and re-emerging pathogens which also cannot be readily treated with available drugs. This is exemplified by viruses such as noroviruses and parasites such as Cryptosporidium. We have increasing numbers of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. We all know of the problems VRE, MRSA, and multidrug-resistant mycobacterium tuberculosis are causing. Many surgical procedures are becoming more invasive, and medical devices for use for them are getting more and more complex and delicate, and too delicate for autoclaving. We have increasing numbers of articles of common use with microbicides built into them. The competition between microbicide manufacturers is fierce, and this sometimes results in aggressive marketing and exaggerated claims. Slide number 11. Okay, I have listed many concerns with microbicides, but what is an infection control practitioner to do when faced with many choices? Let me reiterate the point that no microbicide can be completely non-toxic and environmentally benign. With that in mind, let's see what are the criteria one can look for in a microbicidal formulation. The speed of action is very important in the decontamination of environmental surfaces because microbicides applied on them have a relatively short time of contact to act. Many formulations on the market today claim a contact time of 10 minutes, which is totally unreasonable considering their field application. In the case of medical device disinfectants, there is pressure to turn around the limited number of instruments a clinic may have. Therefore, contact times of longer than 10 to 20 minutes are again not practicable. Microbicides used in automated endoscope reprocessors are somewhat different in that they become part of a process where exposure time and temperature can be pre-programmed. While other points listed here are self-explanatory, let me focus on just two more issues. The negative impact of volatile chemicals on indoor air quality is a rapidly emerging concern. So, more and more microbicides will be looked at for their freedom from volatile organics. Personally, I'm not in favor of microbicides which are persistent or claim residual activity. Persistent chemicals can get into the food chain and can contaminate groundwater. Residual activity raises the potential of generating microbicide-resistant organisms. Slide number 12. Many end users may not realize this, but the reliability of a label claim for microbicidal activity depends heavily on the test method used to generate it. One objective of this presentation is to sensitize you to this issue and tell you about what is being done to correct the situation. This slide shows you the major categories of methods in use to test the microbicidal activity of hard surface and medical device disinfectants. Suspension tests, which are at the top of the table, are relatively simple, but at the same time, easier to pass. At the moment, in the U.S., label claims for mycobactericidal and fungicidal activity are based on suspension tests. Properly designed carrier tests can be more stringent and can better reflect the conditions a microbicide may face in the field. With the exceptions noted above, data generated for government registration of hard surface and medical device disinfectants are based on carrier tests. However, commonly used carrier tests are flawed, and this has led to effort to find better substitute for them. I will tell you more about this in a moment. Medical device disinfectants require three additional levels of testing before government registration. In simulated use, devices such as endoscopes are experimentally contaminated and then subjected to manual or automated disinfection. In field use, the test formulation is evaluated with endoscope used on actual patients. Reuse stress testing applies only to those formulations which are to be sold for repeated use over several days in manual disinfection of medical devices. As far as I know, the only method available for reuse testing is a guideline developed by US EPA in 1984. But the method is quite cumbersome and perhaps needs streamlining and eventual approval by a standard-setting organization such as ASTM or AOAC. Slide number 13. This is just a partial listing of recognized problems with commonly used tests to assess the microbicidal activity of hard surface and medical device disinfectants. I have already written and lectured extensively on this topic, but a few points deserve reiteration here. For example, regulatory agencies must develop better guidance on the need and selection of proper surrogates and soil load in tests for microbicidal activity. Often, no soil load is used. In other cases, its level is unreasonably high, such as when clotted blood is required to be used. This happens in some tests in Germany, for example. Many common test methods are very labor-intensive without the assurance for accurate and reproducible results. They are also anachronistic in many of their requirements and desperately need updating. Methods needed to generate data for government registration of microbicides lack harmonization even within the same jurisdiction. This makes it virtually impossible to assess and compare the level of activity against the various classes of microorganisms needed for testing. Slide number 14. Let me now tell you briefly how we have attempted to address the flaws in microbicide test methods. What I'm about to tell you is based on over 25 years of work, which was supported in part by funds from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. I believe that the two-tiered quantitative carrier test we have developed addresses most of the known flaws in other standard methods in current use. For example, the culture media for the test organisms are simpler and more readily available. The carriers selected allow for accurate inoculation and recovery of the test organism. The soil load is reasonable and compatible with all classes of test organisms. The basic protocols have a sufficient degree of flexibility to allow the incorporation of other types of carrier materials and testing of liquids, sprays, and possibly gaseous formulations as well. Both tiers of a test are now standards of ASTM International, which is a highly respected standard-setting organization. A manual and videos are also available for those who wish to know more about the test protocols. Let me now give you some examples of how the quantitative carrier tests have been applied to evaluation of a variety of microbicides. Slide number 12. This graph shows the activity of a commercially available phenolic against Pseudomonas aeruginosa, a common nosocomial pathogen and an organism required for testing before product registration. The formulation worked well at its recommended use dilution of 775 parts per million in a contact time of 10 minutes in the presence of a soil load. So far, so good. Let's go to slide number 16. But that same formulation shows virtually no activity against the human rotavirus, a non-enveloped virus which often causes nosocomial outbreaks of acute gastroenteritis. What should also be noted here is that the label of this phenolic makes claims of activity against three types of enveloped viruses. What does this mean? This example clearly illustrates several points. Number one, claims of viricidal activity against easy-to-kill enveloped viruses may not mean very much when it comes to dealing with significant nosocomial viral pathogens such as rotaviruses. Number two, claims of activity against vegetative bacteria do not necessarily mean activity against important nosocomial viral pathogens. And number three, that there is a need to select proper surrogates for testing the viricidal activity of microbicides instead of allowing for label claims which are not relevant or meaningful. Slide number 17. Now I want to show you examples of microbicide test data against three types of pathogens of considerable relevance today. This table summarizes our current data or recent data on the activity of seven different microbicides against the feline calici virus, a surrogate for noroviruses. They all showed a higher than 3 log reduction in virus infectivity titer, but with wide variations in contact time. I believe that such comparative testing should help the end user to make informed decisions on the selection and use of microbicides. Obviously, and assuming everything else being the same, something that takes a full half hour to work is not as appropriate as those formulations that achieve the same or higher level of kill in a much shorter contact time. By the way, I hope you all know that noroviruses are a common cause of outbreaks of acute gastroenteritis in community and institutional settings as well as on cruise ships. Slide number 18. Here is another table based on our yet unpublished data. We use human respiratory coronavirus 229E as a surrogate for the SARS coronavirus. I'm sure I do not need to tell you what SARS is. 229E, which is a relatively large enveloped virus, was found to survive longer on environmental surfaces compared to, say, a human influenza virus, and also showed a higher level of resistance to many microbicides in relation to many other enveloped viruses. This is something of a surprise even to us, and this point is being investigated further. However, as shown in the table, many microbicides could inactivate 3 to 4 logs of the virus in 30 seconds to 10 minutes. A word of caution here. Domestic bleach, which has been acidified, is listed in the table, and this acidification of domestic bleach is achieved by adding acetic acid of vinegar to it. Now, this acidification makes the bleach stronger and faster acting, but at the same time, such acidification also releases more chlorine gas, and this could raise workplace safety issues. So here, there is a caution that I want to sound. Slide number 19. This table is also based on our very recent and as yet unpublished data, and is meant to give you a general idea of the application of the second tier of quantitative carrier test in testing sporocidal activity. This information is also quite rare in that we were able to grow Bacillus subtilis and a virulent strain of Bacillus anthracis, the cause of anthrax, under identical conditions, and also tested selected microbicides against them also under identical conditions. What did we find? With the exception of undiluted bleach, the top line in the table, the activity of a given formulation against Bacillus subtilis was quite predictive of its action against Bacillus anthracis. Therefore, Bacillus subtilis spores show promise as a suitable surrogate for the spores of Bacillus anthracis. This information is potentially very valuable to manufacturers, regulators, as well as end users. As expected, there was a wide variation in the contact time needed to bring about a minimum 6 log reduction in the viability titer of the spores at room temperature. Slide number 20. Globally, there is much momentum these days with regards to the development of standardized methods for testing microbicides. ASTM International has been particularly active and has updated or introduced several new standards for hard surface disinfectants and medical device disinfectants. Unfortunately, the US EPA still does not accept data based on ASTM methods, while Health Canada does so. AOAC International, whose methods have been criticized heavily in the past several years, has finally set up a task force to address the issue. This task force is currently reviewing existing methods and will soon make its recommendations to the AOAC. The European Standards Committee has issued several new standards since 1994 and continues to be active in this regard. SEN has an advantage over us in that its standards are issued by the European Commission as directives, which I believe are legally binding on member countries. One other significant development in this area is the recent initiative by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, for short OECD, to harmonize microbicide test methodology in all its 30 member countries. All these countries are industrialized countries. Our center is currently writing a critical review for consideration by the OECD and the European Commission, and we hope that this will result in the harmonization of microbicide test methodology in all OECD member countries. The 5-yearly revision of the Canadian General Standards Board standard on hard surface and medical device disinfectant is now overdue, and I hope this will be initiated. The review will be initiated soon. Slide number 21. Let's come back to the issue of the concerns on the safety of chemicals and how they may relate to microbicides. One recent trigger for this is the potential of certain types of chemicals or their breakdown products to disrupt the endocrine system. Such hormone-disrupting chemicals are also referred to as gender benders, because in aquatic animals, at least, they can interfere with sexual differentiation during development. A book called Our Stolen Future by Theo Colburn and her colleagues alerted us to this issue, and this has stimulated much discussion and action on the topic. Here are some examples on the efforts to deal with this issue of endocrine disrupting chemicals. US and Canada have introduced national strategies to deal with endocrine disruptors in 1998 and 1999, respectively. The European Commission introduced its Biocides Directive in 1998 to review the safety of chemicals, including microbicides, for humans and the environment. United Nations Environmental Program launched a major initiative on chemical safety in November last year, And in May this year, it introduced a convention on persistent organic pollutants, or they are called POP. In brief, there is already much political will at national and international levels to deal with the safety of chemicals. This is certainly an encouraging sign. Slide number 22. As mentioned before, no microbicide can be totally safe, and this is where the ALARA principle comes in. As you can see here, it refers to ways of reducing the toxicity of dangerous substances to levels as low as reasonably achievable. I believe that this approach originated from the safety of dealing with radioisotopes and entails very reasonable efforts to protect worker as well as patients. When it comes to microbicides, the essentials would be, in the application of the ALARA principle that is, better education and training of end users, development and introduction of safer products and procedures and practices, and a more reasoned approach to using microbicides in infection control. Slide number 23. It is quite unfortunate that the progress we have made in the past few decades has also revealed several issues that are harder to deal with. Good examples here are increasing antibiotic resistance and pathogens such as prions. The fact that we have entered the post-antibiotic era, we are seeing a resurgence of interest in disease prevention through environmental control and hygiene. And this is where microbicides play a very key role. In this regard, it has recently been suggested that we should consider our bodies as a microbiome. This is a very interesting and potentially highly useful concept. The main components of it for our discussions here are that the indigenous microorganisms in and on our bodies are an essential part of our biology that must be protected and possibly strengthened. We must accept the fact that microbial pathogens are here to stay, and we are highly unlikely to achieve any final victory against them. This is truly a sobering thought. We must learn to better mobilize our inherent defense mechanisms to fight off harmful microorganisms, and this could include the probiotic approach. Recent outbreaks of SARS, bird flu, anthrax, and other infections have reinforced the need for capacity building for national and global response. This is a significant development and has already been useful in stemming a second outbreak of SARS. In Canada, we'll soon have a separate agency to deal with public health emergencies. Slide number 24. Please remember that many microbicides in use today will be under increasing scrutiny for their safety and microbicidal claims. This may eventually lead to a narrowing down of the available choices. On a positive note, there has been much progress in the development of better microbicide test methods. Now it is a question of implementing their use for regulatory purposes on a much wider basis. The ball has started to roll with regards to regional and possibly global harmonization of microbicide test methods and registration requirements. This makes perfect sense when one considers the globalization of trade. I believe that for positive changes to occur, things must start at the end user. There is still much room to improve the awareness of the issues in the minds of end users, including infection control practitioners. Of course, this is one of the objectives of this teleclass series. Another concern that is raising its ugly head is the combined impact of microorganisms and chemicals. This suggests that relatively mild organisms and chemicals working together may be more potent than either one alone. We will leave that discussion for another day. Please tune in to the next episode of How the World of Microbicides Turns. Slide number 25. Here is a partial reading list for more information on the points raised here. and I'll be happy to provide you with whatever else reading material that you may be interested in. Slide number 26. In closing, I want to thank everyone for listening in so patiently. I must also thank Paul for his continuing commitment to the teleclass series, which is growing and becoming more and more popular and extremely useful indeed. Much of the experimental data I have presented here were generated through the technical assistance of many students and staff at my center, and I do thank them for their continued diligence. Here is the address for our center's website, given in the last slide, and I'll be happy to answer any questions at this stage. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Sitar, for another excellent teleclass, and you are correct. I believe that is your fifth. As always, it has been very well researched and presented. Thank you very much.
Do microbiocides require DIN numbers? And two, what would be deemed effective against Clostridium difficile?
Good questions. Yes, microbicides for use in Canada require a drug identification number, or DIN, and those in the United States require registration with the United States Environmental Protection Agency. Things that are to be used on medical devices certainly are scrutinized much more closely because of the consequences from failure of such high-level disinfectants. The question about Clostridium difficile is an interesting one, and what I suggest is that you might want to hold off for a little while, because we are just finishing a major study on looking at the effect of a variety of microbicides against Clostridium difficile spores. We have already tested some half a dozen different chemicals, and I will soon be publishing data and making recommendations. And by the time the published paper comes out, might be a little too long, but what we will do is post some of that information as preliminary data on our website possibly in the next couple of weeks. And I know that Clostridium difficile is now attracting the kind of attention that it deserves.
Is that some information you can share with me, Dr. Sitar, and I can send it to everyone who's registered for the teleclass?
Absolutely.
Microbicides that have a DIN number do not, in Canada anyway, do not require workplace hazardous materials information labels. Is that correct?
At the moment, they are exempt from the WMIS regulations, but most manufacturers will actually supply with their formulations a material safety data sheet, which gives you much of the basic information that you need on any toxicity issues, how to deal with accidental exposure, how to dispose of these things, and so on and so on.
Dr. Sitar said about the quaternary ammonium compound. What kind of a quaternary ammonium compound is talking about in microbiocides?
Yeah, we are talking about all generations and all kinds of quaternary ammonium compounds, because over the past three decades or so, there have been evolution in the formulation or the design of quaternary ammonium compounds, and they are indeed the most commonly used class of microbicides in North America at the current time. Many countries in Europe do not use them or use them on a much more infrequent basis. Quaternary ammonium compounds are good, mild bactericides, but they have virtually no activity against, on their own that is, virtually no activity against non-enveloped viruses and also obviously against spores. There are issues with the environmental stability of quaternary ammonium compounds, and there are also now reports that inhalation of vapors of quaternary ammonium compounds can lead to sensitization of the respiratory tract.
I have just a quick question for you regarding accelerated hydrogen peroxide at 7%. You have listed here that you have environmental effects. It is my understanding that accelerated hydrogen peroxide, it degrades just to simply water and hydrogen. Am I correct in that?
Yes, you're correct in that, and this is why I am more and more in favor of those microbicides that do their job at the site where they are needed and would then break down into harmless byproducts such as oxygen and water. And this is generally the nature of non-halogen-based oxidizers. That means things other than chlorine. Hydrogen peroxide, if it's properly formulated, and peracetic acid and other kinds of peracids fit into that category. And therefore, they have fewer, as far as I'm aware, fewer negative impacts on the environment. And they also, if properly formulated, can be fast-acting and free from volatile organics and so on.
Thank you. And I will note that you have written an excellent manual on your quantitative carrier test, and that is available through Weber Training. You can contact me if anyone would like that. I've been honored to be involved with that project. Thank you, everyone, for joining this teleclass today. And again, Dr. Sitar, thank you very much for an excellent presentation. Until we meet again, stay safe. Goodbye.